Blog Talk Radio.
The odds of becoming a signed artist and having 3 number one albums? 1 in 100 million. The odds of going on to win 6 Grammy Awards? 1 in 1.4 million. The odds of this performer having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 110. I'm Toni Braxton, and I encourage you to learn the signs of autism at autismspeaks.org. Autism Speaks, it's time to listen. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
Good morning, and welcome to Saturday Mornings with Joy Keyes. I'm your host, Joy Keyes, and I want to thank you so much for calling in or listening on your computer this morning to the show. I hope you had a wonderful week. We had an extremely hot week here in Philadelphia and a crazy storm the other day. I mean, there's trees still all over the streets here. Some just half split hanging in the middle of the street, you know, and hopefully the city will be cleaning those up shortly. But this morning we're going to be talking about education. As many of you know, I'm a parent. I have a teenager. She hates for me to mention her on the show, but she's a very important part of my life, and her education is very important to me, and so that's why I wanted to have this show this morning. I want to read from the book we're going to be talking about, The Death and Life of the Great American School System, How Testing and Choice Are Undermining Education. What should we think of someone who never admits error, never entertains doubt, but adheres unflinchingly to the same ideas all his life, regardless of new evidence? Doubt and skepticism are signs of rationality. When we are too certain of our opinions, we run the risk of ignoring any evidence that conflicts with our views. It is doubt that shows we are still thinking, still willing to re-examine hardened beliefs when confronted with new facts and new evidence. And I read that because I think our guest this morning has done that. And as I mentioned to her earlier, I think it takes great strength, and really the word flexibility came to my mind, of being able to change path when you're in the middle of something. And as she mentioned, there are a lot of people around her supporting her with those ideas and reaffirming those ideas, but then deciding to change. She is a research professor of education at New York University and historian of education. She is a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. From 1991 to 93, she was assistant secretary of education and counselor to Secretary of Education Lamar Alexander in the administration of President George H.W. Bush. From 1997 to 2004, she was a member of the National Assessment Governing Board. From 95 to 2005, she held the Brown Chair in Education Studies at the Brookings Institution. She has more than 10 books. She's edited more than 14 books. She's been in Poland. She's been in Japan, Nicaragua, Germany, and I could go on. But good morning, Diane.
Good morning, Joy. Nice to be with you.
Thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. Again, as I go back to me being a parent and the issue of education being so important, but also in my life and through my family, thank God for that, education was enforced. It was important. There was no question of me whether I was going to school, whether I was going to finish school. It was just, that's just what was going to be done.
Right.
I don't know if you're aware, but here in Philadelphia, we have more than 50% dropout rate of our high school students here.
Right. That's typical for big urban districts, by the way.
So, but that horrifies me because I think, well, when I was in high school, I never even thought about dropping out of school. I didn't like school sometimes. I hated it. I didn't pay attention. You know, I'm chewing the gum and I'm talking and, you know, I got written up for talking a lot. That's probably why I have a talk show now. But the issue of quitting. But with your book, you opened about your change in path. Why don't you explain to the audience why you did change your path from supporting No Child Left Behind to now thinking that that's not the right thing for our children?
Sure. Well, I had been, as you mentioned, I'd worked in the administration of the first President Bush, and I've always been, or have always been, a strong supporter of the idea that we should use tests to find out whether kids are learning or not learning, and to have everyone be accountable. Students, teachers, schools, everyone should be accountable for performance. And when the charter school idea came along in 1990, I was at that time working in the government, or I guess it was at the point I was working in the Bush administration that I first heard about charters. And I thought, well, this sounds like a good idea. Maybe this will help, you know, provide more good schools to kids. So I have, for almost 20 years, been supporting testing, accountability, choice. But beginning in the, I'd say around 2004, 2005, I began to be skeptical about No Child Left Behind, and I guess it's just my habit to be skeptical anyway, because I'm trained as a historian, and that's you don't just take things at face value. So even though I had been a supporter of No Child Left Behind when it was first passed by Congress in 2001, and I thought, oh boy, you know, here we are, we're going to test everybody, find out how we're doing, and then I started to realize, first of all, that the states were dummying down their tests. The scores weren't reliable. Every state was left to come up with its own definition of what proficiency was. And so we saw states saying, oh, we have 80% proficiency, we have 90% proficiency. But then the federal test would come out, it comes out every other year, and instead of 80 or 90%, it would often be 25% or 30% at best.
Wow, big difference.
Wow, you know, like there's a lot of great score inflation going on here. And then in 2006, I was part of a think tank discussion about No Child Left Behind, whether it was working. And they said, now we've had this law for 5 years, is it working? And they had commissioned, this was the American Enterprise Institute, which is a conservative think tank in D.C., and they commissioned a dozen papers. And so these scholars came from across the country, and one paper said, well, it's not working in California. You know, people are not choosing to leave their neighborhood school. And another paper said, it's not working in New Jersey, where there are bad schools. There are no good schools to choose from anyway. It's not working in Miami. There's already so much choice that the choice provision doesn't make any difference. And then paper after paper said, it's not working here. It's not working in rural areas. It's not working there. And at the end of the day, my job was to sum up the papers, and I had no choice but to say, it's not working. I mean, every paper
right.
said it's not working. The choice,
yeah.
I mean, supposedly, for me, the big issue with No Child Left Behind is that, first of all, it set a totally ridiculous and unrealistic goal, and that is that by the year 2014, 100% of children would be proficient in reading and math. And it's okay to have high expectations, but then it established a series of punishments for teachers, for schools, and it said if you don't have 100% of your kids on track to being proficient, your school can be closed, it can be privatized, it can be turned into a charter, it can be turned over to the state. All these really draconian punishments because of a goal that no one really expected to be met anyway. So we're very, very far from the goal. About you know, by federal standards, about a third of kids are proficient, and it's supposed to be 100%. So what's happening all over the country, there are schools closing down because they can't meet that impossible goal. So,
and that's a very horrifying thing, the issue of schools closing down in neighborhoods that already have low resources, if you talk about large minority Latino, African-American neighborhoods. They've lost local businesses. They've lost the middle class. Now they're losing the schools. And if education is the key, I mean, that doesn't make any sense to close a school in an area that needs, if no other place needs it, they need it to help move above the situation that they're in.
There's kind of some sort of magical thinking that's taken over the world of educational leadership. I'm speaking now especially about the Department of Education, but also Joel Klein and the other education leaders who take their cues from people like Klein and Michelle Rhee, and that is if a school has low scores, close it. Open something else, it's bound to be better. But that's not true because, for one thing, you cut the heart out of a community. There was a story in USA Today that stuck in my head because there was a graphic image. It was a photograph of a neighborhood in a poor urban area where, as you said, the neighborhood businesses were closed. People were struggling to hold onto their homes. There were weeds growing in some of the yards, and now they're going to close the school. Well, that neighborhood is doomed. And people were quoted in the article saying, this school is the only thing that's holding the neighborhood together. And why are the scores low? Because the kids live in desperate poverty, and many of them don't speak English. So how does it help the kids to close their school?
Well, you know, I just read an article talking about the the education in our government. California, this is from June 24th, just the other day, California is to receive $416 million to turn around its persistently lowest achieving schools. And what they say in the article, it says, they have these different models they want to use. The turnaround model: replace the principal, screen existing school staff, rehire no more half teachers. I could go on, but in your book you talk about one of the programs that happened out in San Diego and kind of a top-down model there. Tell us a little bit about, tell the audience about your article about lessons from San Diego there.
Well, the San Diego story was about a superintendent who was hired by the business community, basically. They said San Diego happened to be actually a fairly good urban district. It still is. It always has been. And yet the business community decided we have to have higher and higher rates of passing and proficiency and graduation rates and so forth. And these are good things to hope for, but they decided they wanted to bring somebody in who would really shake the system up, turn it upside down, and bring about radical change. Well, radical change seldom ever works in education. Education, by its very nature, is incremental. It's hard work to teach, and it's hard work to learn, and it requires effort, slow, steady, persistent effort. And people just don't get that. But they brought in a superintendent who was not an educator, and he brought in his program, and his program was to, I've discovered the magic method of teaching reading. People at Harvard told me that it works every time. It'll close the achievement gap. And so the program was impose it across the district, make every teacher do it my way. And the teachers, even though the teachers actually didn't disagree with the method, they hated the approach.
Well, let me read something. Yeah, let me read something from your book. The top down, and talking about the teachers, because I think that's something we'll talk about also, is it says, as I interviewed the San Diego educators, I heard recurrent rumors about stress-related illnesses among the teachers, which they call bursonitis. And what Diane is speaking about there is a lot of teachers were resigning, they were retiring earlier because of the stress of working under this relentless model, which, as she said, some of the teachers did agree with, but the stress of it was crazy. And then, I mean, but now here we are again, and they're giving California all this money, and they're going to do it again.
I want to go back to that article about what's going to happen in California. What Secretary Arne Duncan is doing is taking the NCLB models, and the NCLB model is very punitive, very harsh. It's fire the principal, fire either the entire staff or half of the staff. Now, this is not with an evaluation of anybody's work in the school. Close the school, turn the school into a charter school, hand it over to private management. All of these ideas come right out of No Child Left Behind. And I think what's so disappointing for many teachers is that this is, they expected that Barack Obama was going to really represent a different course. They believed in the mantra of change and change and change. They wanted change in No Child Left Behind. And instead, Arne Duncan is really embracing the punishments of No Child Left Behind. He's calling it a turnaround. Well, if you close the school, how do you turn it around? That's like, you're going to turn around something by destroying it. So it's really sad because this means that California's just gotten almost $500 million to close schools, to turn them into charters, to turn them over to private management, to fire the staff. I mean, this is disruptive, chaotic behavior, and it's not about improving schools. It's about taking a mean-spirited approach.
Now, one of the things you also talk about, and you just mentioned, is about the changing to charter schools. And let me read from your book. This is your chapter on choice. The critics quoted one of the leading charter boosters, Chester E. Finn Jr., and he wrote, "Some of the best schools I've ever been in are charter schools, some of which are blowing the lid off test scores in such vexed communities as Boston, New York, and Chicago. And some of the worst and flakiest schools I have ever been in are charter schools, yet people are choosing them." Now, I remember my daughter, she was going from eighth grade to ninth grade, so here leaving elementary to high school. And this whole idea of charter school, it just looked like a dream, you know, that they would have smaller classrooms, teachers would be maybe have more time to be involved, they would be innovative. I mean, it just seemed like it was very romanticized for me as a parent, the information that I was receiving. And I thought, well, if she doesn't go to charter school, you know, then I don't know how she's going to succeed. And there were some very good charter schools, and what I focused on as a parent were the test scores. What are the test scores that kids are getting, you know, on their SATs and all these things, and are they able to get into college and all that stuff? But unfortunately, I also come from a family that appreciates art, and that was very important to me.
That's very fortunate.
It is fortunate. I'm being funny, but by saying that like that. But I needed that balance. I didn't want her just to go to this, you know, all books and, you know, longer hours and uniforms and all that stuff. There had to be some individuality.
You weren't looking for a military academy.
Right, right. And unfortunately, some of the quote-unquote better charter schools that I saw had, to me, this military, that's a very good word, mindset, and I didn't want her to be cookie cutter.
Right.
So tell us about your opinion of the charter schools, because that quote kind of, there are some good ones and there are some bad ones. I mean, what is your bottom line with the charter schools?
See, the bottom line is that the charters, there are 5,000 charter schools, and they range from some that are really get excellent results, which are usually just measured by test scores, and some of them are excellent schools. At the other end, there are some absolutely dreadful ones, but on average, they don't get better results than regular public schools, and there have been a couple of different national surveys or multi-state surveys, and the conclusion is always the same. They don't, on the whole, they don't get better results than regular public schools. So the push to say, which the Obama administration has really been promoting, very much like the Bush administration, by the way, this is real continuity here. And Arne Duncan's been out campaigning with Newt Gingrich because Arne Duncan's program is very much like the Republicans' program, shock, shock. that is that, you know, every state should lift the cap so that they can have more and more privately managed charter schools. Well, there's actually a blog out there, which you could go to the internet and read it. It's fascinating. It's called Charter School Scandals. Go into Charter School Scandals, and you'll see story after story about people who manage charter schools who are ripping off the public, stealing or abusing children, all sorts of amazing scandals. There's one very large chain of charters that's run by some kind of a Turkish nationalist group that inculcates and propagandas as children about Turkish nationalism. All sorts of weird stuff.
It's crazy.
It is crazy, and what happens is, you know, the media focuses on the success story. So they'll say, here's a charter school where everything wonderful is happening. What they never focus on is the two facts. One is the terrible charter schools that are out there, some of which are connected, by the way, with politicians and who are with people who just see this as a money-making opportunity. And they give the kids a very bare-bones experience of just test prep, test prep, test prep, because they're only going to be judged by the test scores. So if they can get those scores, it doesn't matter that they don't have any arts program, they don't have any science, they don't have any laboratories, none of that. And the other thing the media will never tell you is that, or seldom will mention, is that on average charter schools don't produce better results than regular public schools. So why aren't we fixing our public schools instead of investing with a very risky investment?
I want to read another part of your book. You talk about one of the teachers that really affected your life. My favorite teacher was Mrs. Ruby Radcliffe. I too had a favorite teacher, and Ms. Radcliffe sounds like my teacher a little bit. But one of the things she did I thought was very great. After you graduated, she made a gift of a line or two of poetry to each of the students in her homeroom. And the one that you got, or the two that you received, were to strive, to seek, to find, and not to yield. And that's the last line of Tennyson's Ulysses. And also, among them but not of them, from Byron's book. And I thought that's funny because you are definitely striving and seeking continually throughout your life with the study of history. And you were among them but not of them. And I want to let people know you were a Democrat, and you did question taking that position with the Bush administration. But you thought of it as a way to learn more, again, just going on the path of learning. But going to the issue of teachers are very important. And some people say, well, it's the teachers. They're not qualified. They don't know enough. Maybe they're burnt out. Maybe one of the things you talked about in the book was a woman in New York, tenure, trying to pay people off to retire, to give up their tenure. The teachers, I think teachers are wonderful. I had a teacher before this, she had all these test scores. She was teaching me Swahili. She was making me memorize all types of things. She had a red pen like Miss Radcliffe. Mm-hmm. She really pushed us and had high expectations, and that's something you talk about also is the expectations. But going back to the teachers, the issue of tenure and unions, where do you think unions are? Is there a place for teacher unions in schools nowadays? Are there not?
Yeah, I absolutely think so. I think what the country is now possessed with, and our educational leaders at the state and national levels, is this fantasy. And the fantasy is if you just keep firing teachers, you'll end up with better teachers. But they're creating an atmosphere in which a lot of people who might become teachers will think twice and say, maybe I better teach in a private school because I don't like what's happening in public education. I don't like that teachers are being scapegoated. I think they're being blamed for the ills of society. There are many children who come from families that don't care about education. There are many kids who come to school with all kinds of issues in their personal lives that makes it hard for them to concentrate. And yet the teacher is going to be to blame. Well, you know what? If a kid doesn't even show up for school, if they have a high rate of absenteeism, they're not going to get higher test scores, and somehow that's the teacher's fault. As for the unions, I think teachers, like everybody else, they have a right to join a union. And the reason that there are unions is because we have very many cases, especially today, arbitrary leadership, especially non-educators who don't understand anything about education. And teachers feel the need to have representation. They want to have somebody who's going to speak for them, because one of the things I didn't even mention about the charter movement is that it's non-union. There are probably a handful of charters that have unions, but about 95% of them don't. What that means is that they're able to work teachers 50, 60, 70 hours a week, and they are staffed. The charters are staffed primarily by not just non-union people, but by entry-level teachers. So the teachers come and go because they get burnt out after 2 years, 3 years. Then they're gone, and then they can bring in some more entry-level people. This turns out to be, for the charter schools, a very good model because they don't pay high salaries. They pay the same salary as the districts. Maybe they can even pay a higher one, but what they don't have to worry about is tenure or pensions or anything like that. The problem with that whole approach is you can never have a teaching profession if you have a lot of young people right out of college who stay for 2 or 3 years and then leave.
And
so
then leave, the turnover.
Yeah, the turnover is constant, and you don't ever have senior teachers, or you seldom have a senior teacher, and it's about they're cutting the cost that way. But at the end of the day, what we need is a strong teaching profession, and you can't have a strong teaching profession when everybody is hired and fired at the will of the administrator, because they will get rid of people who cost too much money, and those are the senior teachers.
Well, the senior teacher, I think, is the one that's going to look for new ways or really invest in children and have a broad, like a long-term view of how children are developing, and they see the community, if they're in the community, that the parents trust them. If every 2 years you're replacing a teacher, as a parent, if I'm coming into school and I'm like, oh, here's another one, I got to talk to them again about my kid, their likes, their dislikes, their ups and downs, their strengths, their weaknesses. If the teacher's there for, 5 years, 10 years, I trust the teacher, I get a relationship as a parent with the teacher. And so that brings me with the issue of parents, because then people are blaming parents as the problem of why our children are not doing well in the educational system. Parents are not involved. Parents don't have time. There's single motherhood is the cause that they're not around because they're working 2 or 3 jobs. As a parent, it's not easy, raising a child nowadays with all the qualms, in our community, drugs, the violence. Also, as an African-American parent, I think one of the things you mentioned in the book about a middle class, that schools are at their nature middle class, and the issue of racism and segregation in school system. Was it better when, we had all black schools and all white schools and things of that nature? I think that parents have to be involved, and I think there are parents who are not involved. When I go to see parent-teacher conferences, I see very little parents there. I think that is a key. What can we do to get parents more involved? How do you think that can happen?
Well, I think, first of all, I think you're right that parent involvement is crucial. And it's not just, first of all, of course, it's part of it's going to the school and getting to meet the teachers and being involved at that point. But the first involvement starts even before children are old enough to go to school. And the first parent responsibility is, this is, as some people call it, it's the smallest school of all, and that's the home. And that's about making sure that your child gets regular health checkups, making sure that you read to them, that they see you reading, they understand, they will quickly absorb the value of education by your values. If you are indifferent, and if you never pick up a book or read a newspaper, they notice that little kids are very observant. And parents transmit values, a sense of what's important. So I think that's crucial. And I believe that if we had in this country, first of all, concerned parents, involved parents, but also if we could just do something about poverty, the extremes of wealth and poverty in this country today are obscene. And one of the reasons that the charter movement has taken off is because It has the support of a group of hedge fund billionaires who have pumped a lot of money in. Now, if you believe that we should put the fate of our country and the fate of our most vulnerable children in the hands of Wall Street, then maybe that's the way to go. But somehow, I don't understand why they're so committed to this particular reform, and why don't they do something about, let's say, equalizing, not equalizing incomes, because that'll never happen, but about some sort of economic justice where people don't have to live in such terrible conditions. Because, you know, affluent communities have good schools. It's not because they necessarily get better teachers, but they get better resources. I was just talking to a woman the other day. I went to Jesse Jackson's Rainbow Push Coalition 2 weeks ago in Chicago.
I saw that on your blog, yeah. Let me mention about your website real quick. We only have a couple minutes left. If you want to learn more about her, go to dianeravitch.com. You can learn more about all her different books, interviews and articles, different articles she's written. And also she has a blog, Bridging Differences, Education Week, and that was a wonderful. I was just reading about the different places you had gone recently. But go ahead. We have about four minutes left.
Yeah, one of the educators I met there was an African-American woman who was absolutely fabulous and dynamic. And she called me afterwards and she said, I just moved from a very affluent district where the kids had everything. Every child has a personal computer given to them by the district, to a very poor district that's all minority, and the kids have nothing. They have no, they don't even have textbooks. They have nothing. We don't even have supplies. It's in, you know, how can you say that there's a level playing field when the resource allocation is so dramatically different? So rather than pumping all these millions and millions and millions into creating privately managed charter schools, we should be paying attention to making sure that the kids with the greatest needs at least have an equal opportunity.
Definitely, definitely. I have one caller here. Let me see. Good morning, caller. You're calling from 856 area code?
Yes.
Hi, do you have a question for our guest?
Yes, I do. I have a question for Ms. Ravitch. I work in a school district in South Jersey, and I find that a lot of our parents, they want to be involved, or they call themselves being involved, but they just don't know what to do. How much do you believe it is a school's responsibility to educate or inform the parents of just how it is or what they need to do to be more involved, to be more supportive, and to be to help their students and the teachers to be more accountable for what goes on in the classroom?
Well, I think that schools could do a lot in terms of parent education, and by that I mean just explaining about the importance of vocabulary. I mean, where do kids hear the words? They hear them from their parents, and there has just been a ton of research about how kids who come from low-income homes have a very limited vocabulary because they never hear people using words of more than one syllable. They hear yes, no, don't, stop, shut up. Which is two syllables.
And many other things they hear.
and then when they look at kids in professional homes, they come into school with a much, much bigger vocabulary. So I think that there's a lot that can be done in terms of talking to parents about taking their kids to the library, reading to them, looking at their homework with them, letting them know how important school is to the parents and what their goals are for their future. And, you know, just the nightly conversation, not using the television as a babysitter, but limiting time with the computer or the television and making sure that kids understand how much people love them, care about them, and want them to succeed in school. And I think that partnership between the school and the teachers and the parents surrounds the kids.
Caller, I'm sorry. We only have a minute left, but I want to thank you for your question. That was a very good question. And I want to thank Diane for coming on this morning so much. I have so many things I want to ask her and talk to her about. We just don't have time. You're going to have to come back. Please check out her website, dianeravitch.com. Also check out her blog, Bridging Differences. Really continue your work. I think seeking, knowledge is key. And having an educated society is key to bringing us above or at level with the other societies around the globe. And I hope that our new administration, the Obama administration, sees that and stops trying to rehash history, so to speak.
Well, thank you, Joy. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you. Have a wonderful Saturday.
Thank you. You too. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye. Thank you, everyone, for listening this morning. Please follow me on twitter.com/joykeys. Also, you can become a fan on Facebook. Just look up Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. And stay tuned. We're going to be doing a show at 11:30. Find out what Boom Boom cards are. So please stay tuned for that, and I hope you have a wonderful Saturday. And tune in next Saturday, July 3rd. We're going to be doing a show live from Ethiopia. Thank you very much, and have a wonderful day.